So, today, whilst I was doing stuff around the house and avoiding some rather annoying paperwork that I've only just done in the last 40 minutes at the very, very end of the day, I was watching or listening to a YouTube video with Gabor Mate and Adyashanti, I think he's called. His name's probably Frank or Bill, but he goes by the name Adyashanti. Is that a fucking cocktail, lad? And I was watching that, and it was about spiritual maturity. Perhaps I should study emotional maturity. I liked it very much. I like listening to Gabor Mate. He's always pleasant to listen to, and I always feel like I learn something that's profound and sticks with me when I listen to him. And they were discussing enlightenment, and the topic cycled back around to that a number of times, and Gabor Mate was saying, so why are so many Zen masters being done, or have they been done for being sexually exploitative? And Adyashanti was sort of trying to answer that. The issue of enlightenment came up, and this tendency to tell a story of enlightenment based on a spiritual experience or a series of spiritual experiences. And Gabor Mate very honestly said that he'd never had one. Never. Never had a spiritual experience. And Adyashanti pointed out, well, you can be having a conversation with somebody who claims they've never had a spiritual experience and therefore couldn't have experienced any kind of enlightenment, and yet that person is less likely to be triggered. These were his words. And you know, notice generally I try and avoid the T word. I don't like it that much. Less likely to be triggered. And yet you'd have somebody sat right next to them saying they've had plenty of spiritual experiences, but a very, very, to use Adyashanti's specific phrase, easy to trigger. And I thought, hey, I think these fellas have just said something quite profound there, but I'm not really sure what it is. So I had a little bit of a think about it. Another theme in their conversation that was interesting was the sort of, you know, the idea that people talking about spiritual experiences as being primary was actually considered, Adyashanti said, that's a very, very secondary thing. It doesn't really matter all that much. And I was glad to hear him say it. There's two reasons why. One, you know, I've spoken, and it's a running theme on this channel, on the power of stories. It's very, very hard, or not particularly interesting. You won't gather a great audience if you talk about enlightenment without being able to tell a story that is dramatic. So I have a story. I have different spiritual experience stories. The one that I've told that people are the most interested in is the one that I had in Malaysia, that went on for well over a year. I mean, that whole experience, if you're familiar with it, still happens sometimes now. But it's a story. It's appealing. It's interesting. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it has content. And I was thinking about this, and I thought back to my youth when I was studying Zen, and I was studying in my teen years, like personal development, but the spiritual end of the swimming pool, particularly the Japanese traditions, and particularly related to Buddhism and the concept of enlightenment. And one author that I read a lot of in my teens was Dan Millman. His series of books was called Awaken the Warrior Within. And there was a narrative, I think, at that time. I mean, if you think back to the 90s and like the producers, the publishers that were called Sounds True, and there was like Hay House as well. There was Louise L. Hay, Deepak Chopra, Eckhart Tolle, people like that. And there was this way of talking about the experience of awakening as being a one-off. And the Zen tradition is full of stories of one-off experiences. There is a master who, when he's teaching, raises his finger, and then one of his students, his young students, impressionable young students, starts copying the master and talking and raising his finger, single finger, so, you know, the singularity, there is but one. And the master catches him, so he chops his finger off, and he becomes the student in that moment of pain and trauma, becomes instantly enlightened. It's a binary story. Like, he wasn't enlightened, he was a fucking dumbass. Then his finger got hacked off, and then he was like enlightened, and he just stayed that way forever. It was interesting to hear these two men go back and forth about the subject. and just sort of dispel some of that mythology around it. Like, because for me personally, my spiritual experiences that I could tell you about that are colourful, that are interesting, where you can build a movie inside your head related to the words I'm saying, the more interesting ones actually were where I was probably having the least authentic progress in my life. Which is why, ever since I started this channel, when people used to ask me about it back in 2012 and 2013, I'd always be very dismissive and say, don't focus on the sound and light show. You know, I've had people contact me with amazing stories of synchronicities that they've had related to work that they've done, either with other people or through work that they've done, like really, really mind-boggling synchronicities. And they get obsessed with it. And I always just go, well, just don't worry, just let it go. Like, it's a sound and light show. And the reason for being so disparaging is because I sort of instinctively knew that there's not that much to it. It might be interesting and it might titillate, but it's not really progress. Plus, it feeds the ego. Because if I can tell you a story in which a Sufi master decided that I was worth initiating into some sort of unconscious process that involved others for a higher purpose, I mean, that story basically says, I was selected and I'm special. If you had a similar experience and you had a similar story, the ego would come back and eat that snack over and over and over again and get really chubby, get really flabby off that snack, because that's a tasty-ass snack. That's a delicious snack. It's got all kinds of funky elements to it. And people want me to talk about it. I actually had somebody recently say to me, tell me about it, I want to talk about it. And I'm like, I don't know that I really want to talk about it too much, because I don't know what really happened. I can only tell you how I experienced it at the time. But I can also tell you that at the time that happened, I was very mentally ill. I was very, very, very low. Very low. I mean, my CPTSD was eating me alive at that time. And I was desperate. I don't know what happened. And I'm not being dismissive of the experience. And I'm not going to say that didn't happen, because it did. And it didn't happen in a vague, well, he kind of said this. No, that happened. A dude took me to a Malay jungle area, made me do archery. And then when I hit the target, he said, I'm now going to teach you in your dreams, which my first Silat instructor, well, my only Silat instructor that I've ever had, I won't say his name because he's an intensely private guy, even though he is somewhat public. He's not Malay, he's white, and he's Christian. He's not Muslim, and he lives in the UK. He's a lecturer in the UK. And he told me that was his experience of learning Silat in Malaysia years before. He said, I learned Silat through dreams. And I went, did ya? All right, mate. And then I went there and I had this experience. And I just think, isn't this all, there's a certain vibrational frequency, there's a certain energy to it all that just makes you go, this is where you can get lost. This is where you can disappear up your own arse. This is when I can adopt a Malay and Arabic name. And the next time you see me, I'll have like, I can't remember what they're called now. The traditional Malay man skirt on. I'll be doing this. I'll be doing Silat when I'm talking to you. And I'll go weird. I'll go fucking weird because I had that experience and that's mine now. And I own the experience and it's part of me. So I was thinking about all this and I had to do a bit of a drive because I was helping a mate with something. And I had like an hour's, it's like half an hour there, half an hour back. And all this is percolating inside my head. And I went, okay, well, where's the bit of enlightenment? Right? Because if you even say that word, it's like it puts you in dodgy water. Where is it really? And where these two chaps, Gabor Mate and Adyashanti. Hey, Adyashanti, whose real name is Frank Orbel, were chatting. I really sincerely enjoyed the conversation, by the way. I don't know. That's the first time I've listened to Adyashanti, and he spoke a lot of sense. Was that it's never like one experience. It's never a binary situation. You were not enlightened and then you're enlightened. It's always a slow process over time. And the progress that you make won't be sparkly. It won't be a sound and light show. It wouldn't be something you could easily put in a film. It'll be a series of disciplined, consistent actions that take place over repetitively over months and over years. So then I thought to myself, well, what? Because I don't worry about Zen particularly anymore. I don't worry about spirituality. You don't hear me on this channel talking about enlightenment, because I'm like, I don't really know what the fucking hell it is. After all these years, I still don't really know. And then after hearing this conversation, I was like, okay, well, because Buddhism and Buddhist concepts have floated to the surface again for me, I was thinking, okay, enlightenment, I kind of pushed that away because I was like, it's just, I think it's a fetish. And I think it's a fetish in the East. And then the West has gotten hold of it and re-fetishized it and repackaged it. And it means something else to us than it means there. It's definitely a fetish there. It's definitely a masturbatory ego tool, ego masturbation tool there. It is here, but it's different in a different way. It's got a Western flavor to it. That'll have an Eastern flavor to it. But what is it really? And then I went back to my youth, to my adolescence, when I was like, well, what did the Zen tradition teach me? When I was studying the Zen tradition, and I studied it. I was sincere because I thought it was going to save me from what I now realize was trauma. Emotional trauma, psychological trauma, and the complex post-traumatic stress response that was really torturing me in my adolescence, and I didn't know why. In the Buddhist philosophy, I was trapped in suffering. I was trapped in suffering, and that meant I was attached, and then I needed to detach. Well, this is not the lingo that really helps somebody who has trauma. And this came up in their conversation, if you go and listen to it, between Gabor Mate and Adyashanti. Gabor Mate said, listen, all of you spiritual teachers, because Gabor Mate doesn't consider himself a spiritual teacher, you all talk about this stuff, but none of you use the word trauma. Why not? I've never heard you say the word trauma. I've never heard Eckhart Tolle talk in terms of trauma. And Adyashanti said, well, I'm not qualified to talk about it. And I went, ooh. He goes, I feel comfortable, you know, helping people through a process whereby they could attain this state that is called enlightenment. He said, well, I don't feel comfortable helping people get through trauma. I'd send them to a specialist. And I went, ooh, that's interesting. So then that's rolling around in my head. It's okay, well, what was enlightenment? Or what, when I understood it as a kid, in the Zen tradition, it was very sparse and it was very Spartan. It just meant you saw reality as it is, and that's it. You don't add a layer. You don't add projections to it. You don't add story to it. You don't add a layer of butter to it, as the Swedes say. You don't add bullshit. You don't let the ahamkara, the ego, the story maker step in and start adding layers of fluff. It's just what it is and nothing else. And I thought, okay, so if I bring myself out of my own personal story, because that has momentum, ego is big. Ego is a big thing, and it has it powerful. It's muscular. It's repetitious, and it has momentum. It's like the sea crashing in, and it moves. So I go, okay, let's not do that. Step out of that for a second, if you can, as much as you can. What do you think is the relationship here? And I started to think, well, it takes tremendous bravery to see reality as it actually is. It takes tremendous courage to see reality as it actually is. It takes tremendous vulnerability to be prepared to see reality as it is. If we agree, many won't, that that's what enlightenment is the clarity of perception, that the map matches the territory. The map is now not different to the territory. The map is the territory. And the territory is now becoming a fluid map. As much as we, as, you know, singular points of consciousness and human beings with all of our biological needs and contradictory drives are capable of. So you're never not enlightened and then enlightened. You're always kind of just cycling, maybe kind of upward. And then you're either engaging in upward thoughts, words, deeds and intentions, or not upwards thoughts, words, deeds and intentions. And it cycles on like that. Which would be how and why, you know, you do have people who I think actually probably are authentically, and these guys, Gabor Mate and Adyashanti were saying this, they were, I think most of them, the people who are talking about are dead, authentically enlightened in a way that's meaningful and realistic, but they were sexually exploitative and they groped women. And I was like, okay, so what's gone on there then? How do you how do you tally the two? You can either go they're fakes, they're frauds, and they actually weren't, and they were just really good role players, which is entirely possible. We know this. I don't need to explain to anybody watching this how that could happen and what kind of a person would get there. But let us assume that the opposite is true, and naively assume that that's not what happened, and that they actually are, is it possible that they are actually authentically enlightened in a certain way? Yeah, but it's only to a degree. It's only to a degree. You could have a tower, a beautiful, big tower that's really, really impressive and shiny and beautifully built, but you maybe missed a few bricks at the base. There's a bit of cement that you're supposed to mix a little better earlier on down at the base, and you just never bothered to do it. So it is genuine, but it's weak. It's got weaknesses built into it because the work wasn't entirely done. People were shortcutting because we're lazy. As I said in the last video, human beings have a propensity towards laziness, which is natural. And we want the shortcut, and ego steps in, even in the realm of the egolessness. So you have people going, blah, 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 karma, blah, 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 egolessness, blah, 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 enlightenment. Ooh, there's one of my students. Ooh, there's another one of my students. I'll rob this money. We've got cases, well, sidetrack, there's cases in Thailand of some of the Buddhist monks. This is quite common now, city monks gambling, drinking. There's even been cases of rape by robed monks. Robed Buddhist monks, and you think, hang on a second, what's gone on there? So where does it begin and where does it end? And should we have such a fixed concept of it? Maybe the word enlightenment is too used, too abused and not useful. Maybe you should say like clarity or focus or whatever. But to be able to see reality as it is, I think would be the best guiding principle. If we're going to talk about an enlightenment that is for adults and not for kids and not for people who are just trying to impress each other or show off, but something that you could take to the most traumatized people, the people who've been through the absolute worst that this world has to offer, and say, hey, you should be invested in this for your recovery. It would be clarity of perception. It would be seeing the world as it is without the layers on it, which brought me to codependency, because is my energy levels shifted, changed, got better. My hopefulness shifted, changed, got better. I described it as being like the feeling I was chasing when I would do cocaine, when I was a cocaine addict. That's what I was looking for, was this certain feeling of wholeness, of beingness. And that's what dealing with the emotional flashbacks gave me. I've described this in other places, maybe not on the YouTube channel. And now with this, I'm going, as I'm looking at the codependency issue myself, and I've had this personal contract, which is up until this year, everything that I had in my personal life for recovery, I wanted to share with other people. And if I couldn't, I wasn't interested in it, which is a really codependent thing to tell yourself. But that's, I'm just being honest with you, that's what I told myself. I can't share it with other people. It's of no use. This year, because it's codependency, I've gone, look, if I recover and at the end of it, I go, I'm doing really well, I haven't got a fucking clue how to help any of you do what I just did. Sorry about that. Anyway, I'll help you with what I can help you with. That was the price I was going to pay, and just be like, that's tough. And still am committed to that, by the way. I suspect there are processes that I am going through that I'm not going to be able to replicate for people, because it's my process. It's only for me. I'm happy to tell the story. I'd be happy to say, look, in this area of my life, this happened, and I believe this. I did this, this, and this, and then this happened. I can share it with you, but it won't. I'm not sure which parts of this process I can share and that which I can't. But the point I'm meandering, is that dealing with my own personal codependency issues, where I said the CPTSR thing was a different feeling, a feeling of wholeness, a feeling of energy, a feeling of being in the world and being in my own space, is with this one, it's a feeling of like the veil coming off, of scales being lifted from my eyes. It gets tricky because it's a personal process and I don't really know how to convey it. So I'm doing like little leaps and bounds, and then I go, is that a real bit of progress? No, I don't think that's real. I think that's just you pumped yourself up to drop that. Is this real? Yep, that one seems to be sticking. as that little bit of progress is being made, I can look at people and look at situations, people that I've known for a week or people that I've known for my whole life, and I can go, oh, I see. Because I'm now not being the ahamkara for them, for reality. So here's my point.
That is a profound point. I've been thinking about it all day.
So in codependency, as it relates to enlightenment, in the Zen tradition, you're supposed to see reality as it is without projecting story, without adding layers and narrative to it. You're supposed to take it as it is. And you're supposed to accept it as it is. When things happen in our own lives, when we have to deal with situations, in order to deal with trauma, we have to kind of, to use the Matrix analogy, we blue pill ourselves a little bit. You've got to deal with life. It's a natural thing. Dissociation is a natural thing to do. Building nicer narratives is a natural thing to do. But the enlightenment path is to stop that and to go, okay, this is what it really is, just as it is. I have been as a fawning codependent for my whole life, building nice stories, not just for me, but for other people. I'm putting nice stories on other people, making them better than they are in my head, and making them better than they are in their head, because I'm good at this. Because I'm a storyteller, I'm an actor, I'm a writer, and I'm a director. All of these things. Most of you are. Like, some of you literally are. Some of you are literally sat there going, how does he know that that's my fucking job? A lot of you are musicians. You're seeking to please. You're seeking to be the placebo for another person. You're seeking to soothe the pain in the other to soothe the pain in yourself. Another conversation I heard, not today, yesterday, similar situation, procrastinating against doing paperwork. I didn't want to do so, doing other work that needed doing, but really I should be doing the paperwork. Listening to YouTube again. Howard Stern and Stephen Colbert talking about becoming, comedians and, TV personalities and radio personalities, and the sadness in their lives, the tragedy in their lives that led them to that. They both have very depressed mothers. And their only joy in childhood was to put a smile on their depressed mother's face. So they became funny. They're funny men. I mean, if you like them or not, like, that's what they are. I've said, I think personally, the attitude of the stand-up comic and the attitude of the MMA fighter, the attitude of the stand-up comic, the trauma response of the stand-up comic is fight fawn. They're fight fawn responders, which makes them highly narcissistic, because it's a fight fawn CPTSD response that they're working with. It's aggression, but it's also pleasing aggression. Somebody's written, I'm a musician, you're in good company. Many people here are. And so I realized that for my whole life, I've been putting that layer on for others, for me, for them, and just because I think that's what I was trained to do in childhood. Without meaning to, I've stopped. I've just stopped. It's like that button just went click. I had no conscious intent to do that because I didn't really realize it was a problem. Because if you'd asked me, I'd say, you know, I've been around a bit. I've seen a lot of things. I've done a lot of different crazy jobs, and I've lived in different countries. I'm not a naive person. I can see things as they are. I'm a perceptive guy. I might be perceptive, but if you're layering on an extra level all the time to aid other people, you're making yourself very vulnerable. Because, as you know, there are people out there who will say, oh, you like adding on a layer and a sheen to people that make them better than they really are. Fantastic. You're exactly the kind of dummy I've been looking for. Hop on board. Hang out with me because I've got a story for you. And then you kind of make a story together. You make a story together. Two of you are co-creating a false narrative, a story. You're making a movie. You're making a movie, and then you're trapping yourself inside of it, where that would never have been started if you had simply seen that person for who they are from the get-go with no conscious effort whatsoever. I'm not like going, I must today have the discipline of seeing people as they are. I'm just going, oh, there you are. Okay. This person is of good intent, but they are stupid and they will get themselves hurt. But that's not my problem. This person, wow, is riddled with jealousy and actually finds talking to me very irritating and is actually angry and has been angry the whole time I've known them. Wowie. Okay. Well, there's things I've told them and things I've tried to do with that person that I shouldn't have done because this person really actually fucking hates me. Doesn't hate me, but he has an issue with me. This is the kind of thing that you need to know. You need to be able to see friend from foe. And I think a lot of codependents really, really struggle with this, is seeing friend from foe. So the enlightenment element with the codependency and overcoming codependency, you stop layering on bullshit onto reality and onto people into it and just accept it as it is. I'll take a couple of questions, make them one sentence, and end in a question. Tara says, this is why I quit acting. I love being myself now. Yeah, I think probably one of the worst things that people with a pronounced fawn response can do is to actually, if you are successful in that industry, you'll probably just get crazier and crazier and crazier. Which is probably why, you know, so many people who do well there do end up quite sick. I'm stuck on the Zen philosophy. Wowie, how did you get stuck? It's like a filter for the ocean to void a fish. In other words, can meaning be part of what's true? Otherwise, people like Anthony Robbins might not exist. I don't understand what you're saying. These words, I don't understand. I think your point went past me there, Christina. If you could rewrite it, I'll have a go. What should you do if you keep getting into narcissistic domestic violence situations, like a cycle? You should seek to resolve whatever repetition compulsion is there that would make you think that being in a physically abusive relationship is what love should look like. Question. Is it possible to disconnect an existing neural connect? I'm not a neurologist, but yes, we do this all the time. If you stop using it, it will eventually atrophy. I think it's called a neural pathway rather than a neural connect, but yeah. I was afraid of holly weird pedos and abusers, says Tara. That's why you quit acting. Is there a cure for codependency, says Richard Allen. I doubt it. Codependency, like, is part of complex post-traumatic stress. I think that you can, well, I know that you can deal with the two major challenges with CPTSR, as I say, is emotional flashbacks and the superego. Both can be dealt with. The only question is how long it's going to take and how much effort it's going to take. But both have been dealt with. I've developed systems for doing that, and we've had a lot of success with people with bringing their emotional flashbacks down and eradicating them altogether, and of dealing with the superego issues. Codependency is part of the CPTSR spectrum in that it is a pronounced hyperactive fawning response of the four F responses. If I'm talking over your head here, you need to read the Pete Walker book. Pete Walker, like you are walking, Pete Walker. CPTSD, from surviving to thriving. You can get it on Kindle for about $5. Well worth reading. Beyond that, fawn response, it's also a tendency to self-annihilate and to make your own needs nothing and the needs of the other everything. I think it forms earlier than the 4F predominant responses do. And to that extent, it formed when your brain was more neuroplastic and your boundaries were even lower. The 4Fs, I think your preferred F and your preferred sort of, not preferred, but the predominant CPTSD response is probably fixed by 5 or 6. Codependency, I think tendency towards codependency will probably be more laid down before 2 or 3. So cure? No, I don't think so. I think moderate the effects of, change things so that we're better. Better, but not cured. I don't think so. I think it's too early in childhood. I think it's too intrinsic a part of the system. You can definitely make yourself better. What are we, month 5, coming into month 6? I mean, I've seen big improvements in myself. I don't want to say anything yet because you never know. There could be there's sometimes you make improvements and then you lose them. But yeah, better, but I'm cured now. I doubt it. Corey says, I get stuck in end diagnosis articles and videos and get depressed thinking I am the one when I'm sure it's CPTSD. What are your thoughts on this? If you think it's you, probably isn't. if you're sat there going, I wonder if it's me. Most people are in the cluster B spectrum and not unsure of what they're doing. They know what they're doing. All borderlines do it, feel bad about it. Even, you know, your covert or fragile narcissist knows what they're doing, and they don't feel guilt. They feel more shame that they have these feelings of entitlement that lead them to do what they do. But if you're there going, maybe it's me, maybe it's been me the whole time, that's usually a pretty good indication that it's not. Have you ever deliberately set out to manipulate somebody in a way that you knew would be destructive to them so that you would feel better? No, I would never do that. Is it possible that I induced codependency in myself to feel more like a victim and gain sympathy? Is it possible I induced? No. No, you can't induce codependency in yourself. You can't induce trauma in yourself. If you feel like you are addicted to sympathy and to appearing as the biggest victim in the room, then I would say you probably should discuss that with a qualified professional and get some help. It would tend to be more along the lines of you probably vectoring in for more like borderline personality disorder. So if you're doing mental and emotional acrobatics to get yourself into a place where even though it's you doing it, you can abrogate responsibility and go, it wasn't me doing it, I'm the victim here. Do you have coaching slots available? I do, in Los Angeles on the 30th and 31st of May. Information about that is currently available on the website, spartanlifecoach.com, on the homepage if you check the links in the top bar. David asks, how do I stop beating myself up and getting depressed for being single when I want to be single? Kind of feel pressured to find a partner by society. You're getting depressed about being single, but you want to be single. You feel bad about being single, and yet you want to be single. That's interesting. That's an interesting philosophical conundrum. You want a thing, you've received the thing, and you go, thing that I wanted. Oh, good. Oh, I feel bad. Now I have the thing that I wanted. Question, is this the thing that I wanted? Am I telling myself that I want to be single while smothering feelings of sadness and loss and grief for the love that I had that now is not here? Am I telling myself that I want to be single when really I'm yearning to be acknowledged, to be seen for the intimacy and companionship of a relationship? What is the truth of the situation that you're facing? And how can you deal with it and face it in a way that is compassionate to you, compassionate to others, and that means that you can bravely just deal with it without adding a layer to it? Saying that it's society that wants you to have a partner, or here's the thing, I am at this point, like literally in the last few days, I found myself growing more and more suspicious of any narrative that says it's about the culture, it's about society. Sometimes it really is, but many of the people I know who bang that drum the loudest, it's not about culture, it's not about society, it's actually about them. Even I have fallen prey to saying it's about society, it's about culture. And I'm like, I think the word for that is an alloplastic defense. So we've got to be very, very careful that we don't fall prey to our own narratives. As I was saying before, we have to blue pill ourselves a little bit in the matrixy sense to get through life and to deal with trauma. But beware your own bullshit. You know, there's a reality to the situation you face, and it's around pain. And it's around loss, and it's around grief. And in order to deal with that, there's like stories floating around that are going in a circle. Whereas if you just transcend the pain and the grief and the loss that's there, then you can move past this particularly painful story and you won't have to hold it anymore. That's like when a woman doesn't really want kids, but society makes women feel like they should want to have children. Kind of like that. Yeah, yeah. If a woman doesn't want kids and society wants her to, then she can make a decision to say, fuck you, society. And you know what society will do? They'll go, okay. Is it arrogant of us to expect unconditional love and compassion from our parents? No, it's not a question of arrogance or humility or even expectation. Receiving love and support from your parents will make you grow healthy with healthy boundaries and a healthy degree of self-love. Not receiving love and support from your parents will mean that you're growing up with probably varying degrees of a traumatic response to the world. But arrogance and humility doesn't really have that much to do with it. I saw a question float by. Nina says, question, do you feel healed, Richard? It depends which wound you're talking about. Yes, from some, and then from others. From others, I would say no. I think like there are there's all kinds of wounds that a person can experience, and we have blind spots, unfortunately, as human beings. Like you go, you know, like these guys who are enlightened and they're enlightened spiritual teachers, and they're fucking groping their students. Probably a lot of pretty, I doubt that they're telling themselves a story, which is I'm a fraud and an exploitative creep. They're probably telling themselves a different story, which is this is harmless, it's just fun, nobody's getting hurt, something else, right? Which means that the reality of what they're doing is they're putting a layer on it and they're in a black blind spot. So we all do that. So I think I'd be very careful of anybody who says to you with certainty, I know that I am healed. I know that I am enlightened. I'd be like, dude, like how do you know that which cannot be known? How can you consciously know the unconscious? It's not impossible, but it's unlikely. Somebody asked me a question about UCLA before. I saw it float up and I missed it. I'm sorry about that. I'm going to try and find it. Oh, here we go. Richard says, can you tell us a little about your UCLA seminar? I'm in LA that day. It will be great to see you in person. I'll be talking about this. I'll be talking about overcoming codependency. But in that seminar, I'll be sharing some of the techniques and some of the things that I've been using for myself to gain what progress I have gained in, I mean, it's been a big focus in the last 6 months, but obviously it's been something that I've been working on for years. Because I realized, you know, a couple of years ago, I am, like the CPTSD was one thing, but my relationship, not just to people, but to reality itself is quite codependent. I have a very fawning response, and putting myself first is like the biggest, most terrifying taboo one of the biggest challenges I faced as an adult is put yourself first. Go on, put yourself first. And I'm like, oh Jesus, it's much more comfortable not doing that. You know, it's a thing that needs to be dealt with. So that's what I'll be talking about a lot at the UCLA seminar. Okay, any more questions, guys? Ooh, Zero Emission, could you not mention the room, my dude? If you're not, if you're coming to the seminar, the building and the room number, don't share it publicly, please. I do get threats fairly regularly. I do have stalkers, so please don't share that information unless you've paid to go to the seminar. I don't imagine that there will be a problem, but it's all right. So how could you know? It's totally cool. But yeah, just keep it on the down low. I could, if I was really worried, I would get security. I did it at the Liverpool seminar. But yeah, we gotta be careful. You never know. You stalkers, you know martial arts, right? Lol, sorry, hashtag me too. Yeah, imagine the news story. 41-year-old, I'm not an MMA guy, but they'll call me an MMA guy just to make the news story worse. Smashes the cheekbone in of mentally ill stalker. You know, that's if I go to town on somebody, I am fucked. Especially in America. Especially imagine the litigation case. Like if somebody actually comes anywhere near me and I go, right, okay, let's use some fucking combatives now. Yeah, I mean, guys, you hand out years in America like fucking Smarties. I don't want to spend time in an American jail. Thank you very fucking much. So I'd be doing very little. Like if somebody came near me, I'd be like, please stop. Please don't. Please leave me alone. Oh God, don't make me hit you. And then if I had to hit them, I'd be like, eh. This video will be shown in court. Mr. Grannon, were you joking about beating up a mentally ill stalker? Okay. So, the Ancient Lantern says, when I first saw you, made me moderator for your channel, the very first person I had to take action against. I had to completely block and ban them. They said something to you would have made me go nuts. Yeah. Well, you know, it's actually, the channel's pretty good. Because I can log in and there's like a creator studio thing and I can go through the comments. There was a period of a few years ago where it was bad. Like the comments were really, really bad. Now, I don't know if people gave up or what, but like they're really, like the channel's pretty well behaved. And look, like when I say, like I'm talking about stalkers, the way I look at it is I've put myself in certain positions in my life. And this is one of those times where I put myself in a certain position. Of course, it's a tiny, tiny minority of people, but there are people who are, you know, all joking aside, they are disturbed, that there is psychosis, and I've entered their delusion, I've entered their psychotic story, and they're like, I have to talk to you, and I'm like, you didn't have to look up my fucking home address, did you, in order to send me an email. So, you know, it's crazy, but it's not that crazy. Generally speaking, like if you look at, because like right now there's like 409 people watching. There's a lot of people who watch the videos. If you look at the sheer number of people, the overwhelming majority is really good, really, really positive. The comments are super positive. People are educated. They're fluent on the topics. They're nice to each other. I mean, Jesus, like elsewhere on the internet, you go through the comments and people are like flaming each other, trolling each other, arguing, they're saying nasty things to each other. You don't really see that on the channel. So I'm happy. I'm happy with that. I'm grateful for that. I understand about stalkers. I had to stop going for my walks on the beach for a few years because men followed me in their cars and contacted me via social media. One even came to my work. Yeah, that is super, super creepy. Okay. I will answer this last question. Do you think love can work between two codependents who are working on their issues? Absolutely. Why not? Why not? I mean, look, don't create false binaries. There's no such thing as like enlightened, unenlightened. Oh, that doesn't exist. And there's no such thing as like codependent, traumatized PTSD sufferer, and then wonderful, magical unicorn human who has nothing. I mean, everybody's traumatized. Life is traumatic. The world is built, I think, on trauma. The world is a reflection of trauma. Architecture, music, painting, media, laws, it's all trauma-based. And relationships are, in their essence, a kind of codependency. This notion that you have two completely independent, sovereign individuals who are totally equal, and you know, everything is balanced. It's fucking horseshit. It's horseshit. Show me the person who says that they're living that, and I'll show you a fucking liar. It's messy. Life is messy. Humans are messy. You've got to be compassionate to yourself. You've got to be compassionate to other people. Of course you can work it out. Of course you can. But you know, people will give you the advice. You've got to be open and talk to each other, and you've got to be honest with each other. I would say, yeah. But I would invert it a little bit. I'd say you've got to be honest with yourselves. Each one of you in the relationship needs to be telling the truth to yourself at all times. And that's hard. That's a hard thing to do. If we're going to talk enlightenment, that's the enlightenment I want. Something that's got some grit to it, that will last, that would survive a bomb blast. I don't want some fucking airy, fairy, fluffy enlightenment where, like, if my robe gets dirty, everything is ruined. I have a tantrum. So you want clarity and you want self-honesty, but yeah, absolutely. Two recovering codependents can figure it out. Why not? Why on earth not? Okay, last question. How can you regain trust in your own judgment through the healing process? I don't have my whiteboard, and I don't remember the video where I did this. If anybody knows the video, please link it in the comments after this is uploaded. So usually what I just plan to do is I draw an eye, and I go, this is like the eye of Sauron, and then I draw a little stick person, and I go, you're watching you. Your unconscious is observing you. So as you go through time, and you do things, and you take actions, and make decisions, and those decisions have repercussions, karma, you know, karma without the woo, you know, just like good intent usually brings like good rewards, good results, that kind of thing. This eye will go, okay, this person is going somewhere good. We can trust, I can trust that we're going to a good place. So you have to actually start making good decisions, which means you've got to clear up your decision-making process. So you can't just ask of yourself, trust, and the self will go, fuck you. I've seen the decisions you've made. They suck. Fuck that. I want to be anxious and I want to send this anxiety feeling to you so that you wake up, because anxiety is the wolf. I'm reading a story right now. It's by Robin Hobb, called the Farseer Trilogy. And a guy becomes, you know, bonded psychically with a wolf. And when he's about to be, the wolf watches him when he sleeps. And when he's going to be attacked by the zombies of this world. Yes, I know, it sounds very Games of Thronesy, and these two know each other. They both wrote it in the 90s. When the zombies are going to attack, like, the wolf will come over when he's sleeping and, like, poke him in the face and, like, bite him. And go, wake up, you've got to run, you've got to fight, you've got to do something or you're going to die. The anxiety is that wolf that's saying, wake up, get up, do something. So never, don't just go, oh, I feel anxious, I want to feel okay. Oh, there we go. Oh, that's better. Or cheeseburger. Just kill the anxiety. But okay, I am an intelligent, evolved system. And when I feel something, I'm going to assume it's for a purpose. And if the purpose is intelligent and it serves me and it's towards my survival, I'm going to listen to the impulses that I'm getting. If you feel anxious about and wary of your capacity to make judgments, let's assume that you're making bad judgments and bad decisions. And we go, okay, I make poor judgments and I make poor decisions, and I have done. Why? And how do I improve that? So then inside your head, you have a new reframe for the situation. The problem isn't that you don't trust yourself, because you shouldn't trust yourself if you're making shitty decisions. Your problem is that you make shitty decisions. And you go, okay, in my life, I've made bad decisions. I need to prove to myself, for my trust to come back and my self-esteem to come back, that I can make good decisions. All right. The next time I make a decision, instead of being silly Billy and being all daft about it and just fluttering in like I normally would and going, woo-hey, and just doing whatever and trusting in fucking Vishnu or whatever, I'm going to stop. And I'm going to be a grown up. And I'm going to take a breath. And I'm going to take a pen and a piece of paper. And I'm going to go, this is my decision that goes this way. This is my decision that goes this way. These are the pros and cons. This is some basic ass life coaching I'm giving you right now, but you should do it. These are the pros and cons if I decide this way. These are the pros and cons if I decide that way. What decision should I make now that is going to cause me the least regret in 10 years' time? What decision should I make now that reflects my highest values? What decision should I make now that makes me safe? What decision should I make now that's going to allow me to thrive and to grow as a human being? Which is the best decision I should make? Becomes a new discipline, becomes a new way of living your life. And it's one way, one of the many ways of overcoming the tendency towards codependency. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time and for your attention. I do appreciate it, and I look forward to speaking to you soon. Cheers.